Hi, my name is Carmen. And I'm a grateful member of the Worldwide Fellowship of Al-Anon and Alateen, and my home group is in Greenville, South Carolina, Progress Not Perfection. And I'm supposed to tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today. So what it's like today, I have a sponsee who likes to say, it's a good day because I didn't sleep with any of my exes. So we'll start with that and know that it is a good day. I am a product of the multi-generational effects of the disease of alcoholism. And I talk about that a little bit just because I think it's important for me to understand where I came from so that I don't have to carry all of that blame and shame. My dad had an alcoholic father, and when he was younger, his father kidnapped him and one of his brothers. And it took a while for my grandmother's family to find out where they went. And so they were up in Michigan at the time. And so my grandmother ended up kidnapping them back, went down to Florida, and then he spent the rest of his childhood kind of living off the grid to make sure that the kids weren't going to be found. My mother, back in the 40s, her mother, my grandmother, decided that she was going to get a divorce. And that was back when character witnesses were really big. And so the alcoholic grandfather had a character witness to say that my grandmother was having an affair. I don't know whether my grandmother was having an affair or not. What doesn't really matter. What matters is the fact that in the 40s, they were granted the divorce, but she lost full custody of 6 children, and she had to pay all the court costs and all the attorney's fees. So they are standing on the courthouse steps, and my grandfather turned all 6 kids over to the state. So my mother grew up in a children's home for the rest of her childhood. And so I was a product of these two really broken people. And this Al-Anon book, From Survival to Recovery, is specifically about people who survived growing up in the disease of alcoholism. My father eventually became an alcoholic, and my mother is still alive, and she is still untreated Al-Anon. But I want to read this paragraph because I think it describes me perfectly. It's on page 14. Growing up with the chaos and unpredictability created by alcoholism caused many of us to mask our confusion, anger, and shame by trying to be perfect, to prove to ourselves and the world that there was nothing wrong with us or our families. We scrambled hard in school to get straight A's or work feverishly at home to keep everything neat and tidy. We became star athletes, artists, corporate leaders, humanitarians, and outstanding citizens. Inside, however, we feel driven, terrified of failure, unable to relax or play, and lonely. Towards less responsible people who seem to make our efforts at perfection harder, we often feel self-righteous and angry. Convinced that something terrible will happen if we lose control, we run ourselves ragged by trying to take charge of everything and never know how much is enough. Until we begin to recover, many of us are trapped in a compulsive need to give more, love more, and do more. And that has been me. That is my story in a paragraph. But I'm going to tell you what happened. So growing up in the disease, and probably everybody in this room understands the infidelity, the bloody fights, the broken bones, the police, the screaming, the hiding, just the chaos. There's a line in a song written by Towns Van Zandt. It's a Willie Nelson song. But anyway, there was a line that says, he wore his gun outside his pants for all the honest world to feel. And that was my dad. He wore his anger all over, and he spread it like it was fertilizer. and so I learned a lot of negative things growing up. I like to tell two stories to talk about those two things that I learned most, and that is despair and perfection. And I don't think either of those are healthy. but when I was seven, my dad bought a component stereo system. Well, I don't know about anybody else, and a lot of the people in this room are probably too young to remember how complicated component stereo systems used to be. Well, if you take an alcoholic person who has no mechanical capability and you ask them to put a component stereo system together, it was impossible to do. So he was drinking, got angry, because my mom was like, well, can I help you? Well, no, he got angry at her. It was January. He put her outside. Well, she was outside in her nightgown and bedroom shoes and nothing else in January. And so my windows were really tall in our house. I don't know why. It might have been because I was only seven. But anyway, I could throw things out of the window, but she couldn't. I couldn't reach to open the window and for her to crawl in. So I had my sister had just been born. She was in a different room. And I would pretend like I was going to check on her so that I could take my mom a blanket or something that could try to keep her warm. And we waited until my dad passed out. And in one of my little trips through the house, I had unlocked the back door. So we waited until my dad passed out. She came in. She got me. She got my sister. We went and we got in the car and we were going to leave. And this was very exciting to me. We were going to finally leave. So we sit in the car, and my mom went to crank it, and it goes, rrr. And I'm going, you got to try again. Rrr. Well, after about the third time, my dad comes flying out of the door, landing on the hood of the car, and that was it. Our attempt at leaving was gone. So it was another 3 years when my mom decided to leave during the middle of the day when my dad was at work. And my dad used to hide money, because the banks weren't good enough. So he would hide it in books, but he only told me where the money was. So my mom said, okay, so I want you to go and get $500, but I want you to take a little bit from a bunch of different books so that he doesn't notice. Well, when we got in the car and we were driving out of town, my mom looked at the money and she said, well, there's only $400 here. And I said, no, it's $500 because 420s equal 100. And she goes, no, 420s don't equal 100. 520s equal 100. That's why we've only got $400. Well, that set the stage for the rest of my life that said, I will never make that mistake again. I will never make an academic mistake where I don't know how to do any kind of math or anything again. So I had a lot of despair and this over driving perfection because of inadequacy for many, many, many years. But here's what I've learned in Al-Anon. And I want to talk a lot about what I've learned in the middle of the stories, because the learning process has been incredible for me. I've been in a long time. I've been in for 33 years. I came in when I was 26 years old. I don't know exactly what time of year it was when I came in. I just know that at 9 o'clock at night, it was still light outside in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, because that's where I first came to the program. But I've learned a lot. And life happens, and bad things happen to good people. And thank God I've got this program to get me through all of that. But what I've learned because of Al-Anon is that in the chaos, I can, like, I'm totally on spot. I can focus, I can problem solve, I can keep moving forward. And that helped me in my job, that helped me in my career. You know, I can't look at everything that I learned in the disease of alcoholism and say that everything was bad, because it hasn't. You know, what has not worked for me are the extremes. And that's where I've had to let go of some of what I've learned growing up. I have learned to talk about anything. You can put me in front of literally anybody in the world, and I can talk about anything. My dad used to play poker, so what did I do to try to distract him when he was super angry and super drunk? I learned how to play poker. I learned how to talk about sports. I used to even get a subscription to Sports Illustrated just so I could talk about sports, and I don't even like sports. Like, to this day, I don't like sports. But I would learn how to talk about all the baseball players and the basketball players and the football players so that I would distract the angry chaos when it would kick in. I learned how to be adventurous. My dad would wake us up at midnight and say, "We're going camping at the beach for the weekend." And, you know, my job was to put my sister and all our stuff in the car so that all he had to do was drive to the beach. And to this day, if somebody were to wake me up and say, "Let's go to the beach," I'd be like, "Okay, I know how to do that." You know, that's not a new thing for me. I learned spontaneity. One of the best things my dad ever did, from that perspective, for teaching me spontaneity, is he used to drive the back roads in the country. And every so often you'd see these garages, and those garages would have a light on. And, you know, they'd have a few men sitting in those garages, sitting around talking. And so my dad would stop, and invariably, we'd be sitting in the car for like an hour because he'd go in and he'd talk, and you'd have to just sort of entertain yourself. Well, one time, he came out, and he had traded the car that had four people in it for an MG. Well, then we had to figure out how to fit four people in an MG. My sister and I were laying on top of each other at the very back behind the seats in order to get home. It doesn't faze me today if somebody asks me to stand upside down in order for us to do something. I'm like, okay, well, I've done that. I have a work ethic. My dad, when I was growing up, we lived in an area that didn't have alcohol on Sundays. So my dad bought a convenience store so he would have ready alcohol. And I learned to work there. I learned to make sure that the shelves were stocked and check people out. And, you know, having a good work ethic, I think, got me through having a career. Well, when I was 16 years old, my dad found AA. And I think he really worked the deal. He really did. I remember when he did his ninth step. I remember where we were. I remember how he did it. And so I believed that he was working the AA program at that particular time. But as everyone knows, the damage at that point, the damage to a child growing up in the disease of alcoholism has already been done. So at age 22, I did the statistically correct thing, and I married an alcoholic. I counted alcohol. I sacrificed. I could take a chicken, and I could boil that chicken, and I could use all the meat on the chicken. I could use the broth off the chicken, and I was so proud of myself that I could save so much money on just taking a chicken and using every single piece of it. I checked car odometers, and I slept around. You know, I did what I do when you have a love cup that has not been filled by your parents. You do what you do when you have a love cup that hasn't been filled with a higher power. I remember at one time, my first husband was, and I don't say first husband lightly, because, you know, you don't have a husband number one unless you've got at least more than two, because otherwise it's a previous husband. But on husband number one, I remember we were, he was in the military, and he was going out to some war games or some kind of something like that. He was seeing somebody, I was seeing somebody, and we were in Germany. And the way that they had it in Germany is the plug went to the wall, and then it had a cap over it for the phone. And so what I did was I picked up the phone while he was gone to call the guy I was seeing. Well, it didn't work. The dial tone didn't get there. So I followed the cord. It went into the wall. I took the cap off, but the plug was not all the way in. So I thought, he has unplugged this phone because he didn't want his girlfriend to call while he was gone. So I plugged the phone back in. I called my guy, and then before I took the plug back out, and then I stuffed the hole with paper because I wanted him to know when he went to plug the phone back in that I knew that he had unplugged the phone. And do you know, we never talked about that? He did. He took the paper out, plugged it back in, and we never talked about it ever. So we were in Germany for 2 years, and I decided that I wanted to leave. Well, in good Al-Anon keeping, I did not want him to have the silverware. It was like a 200-piece silverware that I had gotten when we got married. Well, this was right after the Pan Am flight blew up over Lockerbie, Scotland. And they had estimated that that flight had originated out of Stuttgart, Germany. Well, I was flying out of Stuttgart, Germany, with 200 pieces of silverware wrapped in my clothing. And I get to the airport like 10 hours early because I just needed a ride. So I just got a ride whenever I could get a ride. And I'm waiting around, then I check in, and then the security people come and get me, and they say, why do you have all this silverware? And I go into this diatribe about how that SOB is not going to get that silverware. I want the silverware, and that's why the silverware is in my clothes. And I'm sure they thought that I was a lunatic, because they assigned me a security officer to escort me all the way back to Atlanta, Georgia. Like, I could not go to the bathroom by myself. That person sat beside me the entire time and followed me all the way through customs until I got off the plane. And it didn't occur to me till years later that I must have been an absolute lunatic when I was talking to those security people. So I got back to the States. And, of course, I had to get back together with him. He came back to the States. We got back together. And eventually, I decided that I did not want to be married to him anymore. I was tired of the disease of alcoholism. And so I filed for divorce. And he said that he would fight it. And I thought, right. So we show up at court, and he did fight it. And the judge felt like that he was a legitimate case. So this was in the 1990s. I'm not lying to you. In Tuscaloosa, Alabama, Judge Conger, I'm not sure I wouldn't run over him if he stood in front of my car, decided that his court order was that we reconcile and that we could not get a divorce until we had had sufficient time to reconcile. So There we go, living together again. Well, that lasted for, I guess, about a year. And my plan was according to my attorney, I could put an ad in the newspaper after 7 years. And if he didn't respond to that ad, I could get a divorce. So that was my plan. So I said, look, you got to go. And he said, well, I can't go because I don't have any money for an apartment. I said, okay, well, I'll get you an apartment. And then he said, but I can't move into my apartment because I don't have any furniture. And I said, oh, okay, don't worry, I'll get you some furniture. And then he said, well, I can't move into my apartment because I don't have any bedding. And I said, okay, well, we'll get you some bedding. And then he said, well, I can't move into my apartment because I won't be able to pay my utilities. I said, okay, well, I'll pay your utilities. And then he said, I can't move into my apartment because I don't have any kitchen goods. And I said, okay, well, we'll get you some kitchen goods. It took me 5 years to pay off that debt. I mean, how crazy was it? At no time did it ever occur to me to move. At no time. I wasn't going to move. Like, I'm paying for him to leave, but it never occurred to me that maybe I could leave. That's how crazy I was. So by the time I was 23 years old, I was working on my third college degree and my first divorce. And so I started early. Well, what I didn't tell you is that when I first, right before I went over to Germany, a friend of mine had said, have you ever tried Al-Anon? And so I went, and they didn't tell me how to fix him, so I didn't go back. Well, 4 years after first trying Al-Anon, I came back, and I came crawling back. Oh, my God, it was awful. And I remember our very first speaker meeting, there was a woman named Yancey, and Yancey talked about, I had not been in very long, and Yancey talked about how before Al-Anon, she would come up with these scenarios for every possible situation that she could be in so that she could make sure she handled the situation correctly. And now that she was in Al-Anon, she didn't have to do that. And I remember thinking to myself, oh my God, you're not proud of that scenario thinking. And I have placed my entire life on that scenario thinking where I've got to know how to handle every situation perfectly. And it was the first time, I believe, that step one came to life. The idea that my life was out of control because my thinking was out of control. It didn't take me long to realize, and I hear people talk about their qualifier. I am my own qualifier. It has absolutely nothing to do with the people in my life. I am the one that creates the chaos in my life because of the reactions that my brain has to things that go on around me. When I first came in, I heard I had choices, and doing absolutely nothing was a choice. And that took a lot of pressure off me. I have a very, very, very high threshold for pain. And I think that's the reason that my reality has been distorted all these years. And that's what makes step one tough for me, is that I have a unique ability outside the normal world to just create either terribly negative things or incredibly positive things. There's no reality there. But I learned that this pain was inevitable, but that misery is optional. I had a choice as to whether I was going to be miserable or not. I also heard that I should keep coming back, I should come back until I want to come back. And that was very significant to me because I was so angry. I didn't want to be here. I drew the short straw. It made me so angry that I was in the program. It made me so angry that I needed the program. And 33 years later, I still come back because there's still that sliver in the back of my mind that says, oh my God, do I really want to be here? Probably not. But I come because I'm grateful, because it gave me a way of life. I went to a lot of open AA meetings in Tuscaloosa. The meeting that I went to was at a clubhouse, so I was able to be around a lot of AAs. I'm always so grateful for that. On page 26 of the One Day at a Time reader in Al-Anon, it says, "No one can control the insidious effects of alcoholism." And I learned that from the AAs. I absolutely learned, because nobody would go to the depths of despair and nobody would make the choices that I've made in life if they were able to control the effects of the disease of alcoholism. Step two gave me comfort. When it talked about restoring me to sanity, I thought, well, maybe there's hope. There's hope that one day I can become the person that I wanted to be. I struggled with step three. I bought into the idea and still believe that I hear my higher power through other people. My higher power is the group with skin. And I hung on to that, but I had to give up the idea that my higher power was a terrorist. And that took me a long time. And I remember when I was talking to my sponsor about this, and I was telling her about my, you know, idea of a higher power, and she said, "Oh my God, your higher power is a terrorist?" And I'm like, "What are you talking about?" And she's like, "Well, look up the definition." I'm like, "Oh my God, where in my life did I decide that my higher power was going to punish me for all of my thoughts that might come through my brain?" But my brain is not my friend, so I have to not listen to that. I have to check in with a sponsor. And, you know, I wanted early in the program to have some dignity. And I'm not saying that this, I hit this perfectly, but I learned that I was going to have to stop begging. I was going to have to stop pleading. I was going to have to stop trying to educate my way into getting what I wanted. I had to stop using sex. I had to stop trying to sweet talk. I had to stop trying to manipulate. It took a long time, and we're going to get to that in a second, but it took a long time for me to get to a point where I was saying, okay, because I think steps 6 and 7 for me were probably some of the hardest, to say, I'm ready to let it all go. I'm ready. All of the barriers to being happy, joyous, and free are my problem. They're all my problem. But I got to let those barriers go. And it took me a long time to get there. So let's talk about sponsorship for a second. I think sponsorship is important. The first sponsor I had was really nice. She was super nice to me. And it was probably what I needed at the time. My second sponsor, who I had for many, 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 many years, and many of you may know her, Kitty, I did not like her. She would laugh. She would file her nails in meetings. And she would tell it like it was. And I thought, there's something wrong with her. I don't like her. But they told me, pick somebody who has what you want. And I wanted to be as happy, joyous, and free as she was. So I had a real hard time going up and asking her, because she was intimidating to me. So I wrote on a little piece of paper, "Will you be my sponsor? Circle yes or no." And she circled yes. And there in lied a couple of decade relationships. She said to me, "You should be an Alateen sponsor." I said, "Okay. I'll do that, because, you know, I came old school. If Al-Anon comes calling, you say yes." Then she says, "You should be the literature coordinator." And I said, "Okay, I'll do that." And then one time we were at Area Assembly, and for those people who haven't been to Area Assembly, when we elect our elections or elect our officers in Al-Anon, we ask people to stand who would be willing to serve in that position, and then everybody else votes on it. And so I was on the second row. Kitty was on the first row, and they called treasurer. And Kitty turned around and gave me the look. And if you have a sponsor, you know what that is. It's a magical look. And so my body levitated out of my seat. And they had me come up to the platform. And there were other people who had been accountants and run their own business and all this other kind of stuff. And I walked up and I said I was married to an alcoholic and did not have to file bankruptcy. And they elected me treasurer. And that was a great learning experience. But I love sponsorship. I get more out of being a sponsor than my sponsees. And I would encourage everybody who doesn't have a sponsor to take that leap of faith. So 5 years into the program, my sponsor said to me, "You are institutionalizing yourself in Al-Anon." And I'm like, "What are you talking about?" She's like, "Well, yeah, you're working your program, but you go to work, you come home, Al-Anon people take you to the grocery store, you sit in the Al-Anon rooms or the AA rooms until you have something that you have to do, and then you go home and then you do it all over again. You are institutionalizing yourself. You have to start dating again." And I said, "Okay." So I started dating again, and I do what I do. I got married to husband number two, and, you know, I'm in the program at that time, so some people should say, "Well, why would you get married?" But anyway, about that same time, after 15 years, my dad decided that, through some successes maybe that he had in his personal life, decided that he was not going to go to AA anymore, and he went back out. And I was in the program 11 years when it became very obvious that his home had been turned into this weird den of, weird, lot of weird stuff going on. And so he agreed to move to Tuscaloosa. And the night before, you can't make this stuff up. The night before, I was supposed to fly to Orlando, get a rental truck, pack all his stuff up, bring it back to Tuscaloosa. He caused a 5-car wreck leaving a bar. And he called me drunk as Cooter Brown and wanted me to come get him. Well, I'd had enough program at that point to say, "I'm not going to be able to do that." And I got off the phone and called my sponsor. My sponsor came over and got me. But in the meantime, he was telling this random woman what was going on. She calls me to, blast me because what a terrible daughter I am. Well, in the meantime, I go to the meeting, I come back from the meeting, he calls me and tells me he's going to turn me into DHR for parental abuse, and that he is great friends. There is a street in Tuscaloosa called Jack Warner Parkway. He has made great friends with Jack Warner, and Jack Warner is going to get me fired from my job. It was just all of this standard, I'm going to wear my anger, and I'm going to come up with the most creative ways to make you think you are losing your mind. And I said, "Well, Daddy," because he was living with me at the time, and I said, "Daddy, you can't stay with me. You're going to have to find another place to stay until I get back with all your stuff and we move you into your mobile home that we had rented." And so I went ahead and went down to Florida, came back, got back to his place, and he had been sleeping outside for 3 days. And, you know, that's when I had an alcoholic father. Fast forward 4 years, I go to vote for a local election. And it was at the mall, and I go walking up to the table, and I knew a lot of people. And everybody around me I knew, and I go walking up to try to, you know, get your ballot, check in, whatever you do. And over to a different table was this person who was just screaming and yelling and cussing. It's their God-given right as an American to vote. And all the people that I was around started talking about how this lunatic was just screaming and yelling. And I looked over, and it was my dad. And I remember right then, I remember it as vividly as I'm standing right here. I had no embarrassment. I realized at that second, he, somewhere along the line, through the program of Al-Anon, stopped being my alcoholic dad and started being my dad. And I said, oh my God, that's my dad. And they're like, that's your dad? And I'm like, yeah, let me go see what's going on. So I go over there, and he's like, these people won't let me vote. And I said, oh, Daddy, you're not even in this area. This is just a local election. He's like, oh. And he turns around and walks out. And I go back to my little group of people, and they're like, that's your dad? And I said, yeah, he got confused. This isn't his election. And they're just standing there with their mouth open. And I realized this program works, because at that moment, I was no longer angry at him. I no longer had resentment. I think the resentment and the anger had been leaving me because my sponsor made me do service work for him in order to help me fill my love cup. So there were a lot of things about my dad in the throes of the disease that I couldn't deal with. But I could mow his grass, and I could weed eat. Now, he'd stand on the porch and tell me where I'd missed a spot or if he didn't like that. But it didn't matter. I was being of service. And that changed my heart. That changed my heart. So in August of 05, Katrina hit. And God did for me what I could not do for myself. So husband number two was away, and he called me, because I didn't have, this was pre-cell phone, and I didn't have power, and I didn't have cable. And he said, oh, I got to go. I'll call you back in a little bit. And I said, well, I really need to know what's going on, so if you could watch the news, that would be great. He didn't call me for almost 24 hours. And that's when I snapped out of reality for just long enough to say, I wonder what the problem is. So I did what I do at that time, I started looking for love in all the wrong places. And we got divorced in January. After that August, my dad died. In the last year of his life, he lost 60 pounds, and he got to the point where he could barely walk from the disease, and he, you know, the inside of his place was terrible because he couldn't make it to the bathroom, and I would bring him food, I would leave food, he didn't eat food, he only drank, and that was, I lived what they talk about in AA, about how the disease of alcoholism progresses whether the person is drinking or not. When he picked back up after 15 years of not drinking, it is like he had been drinking all along, and he went 0 to 100 in 3.4 seconds. And he died at 67 years old. And my husband just turned 67. So it is so weird to me to think about that. But here I was. In 3 months, I lost a husband. I lost my father. I lost a business because I had it with my husband number two. And weirdly enough, I was in the middle of adding on to our house, and I lost my contractor. And it's like everybody's like, oh, we don't want to know you, Carmen. But I had to go back to square one on my program. And at this point, I had been in for 15 years. I began to realize that there's a huge difference between relief and recovery. I think relief has its place, and I think relief helps. But at a certain point, I had to kick in and realize that if I wanted to have something different, I needed to do something different. And that required me to revisit step three. I very much still had what I like to call a parking spot God. You know, it's Christmas, you're driving around, you're at the mall. Please, God, help me find a close parking place. And then you actually get excited when you find one. And in some part of the back of my mind, I'm like, yeah, there is a God. He's the parking space God. Well, I had to give that up. And I had to redefine my higher power with love and light and clarity and wisdom. And I started with having the group all over again love me until I could love myself. I needed some external validation. And I did that starting with the group and then with a higher power that I could reimagine. After 15 years, I finally was willing to get on my knees. I had to commit myself to maturity. Mature people understand their value system. They understand how that value system works in their life, how to set those priorities. And so I had to look at the fact that I still had a step one problem of living in reality, and I had a tradition six problem. I'm like, if anybody asks you what you think is the most powerful piece of literature in Al-Anon today, I would tell you it's Tradition 6, where it says, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary spiritual aim. How embarrassed do I get? Am I afraid that you know my story? Am I afraid that you will judge me? Am I afraid that you will think bad things of me? That's a Tradition 6 problem for me. And that's where so many of my problems came from. When I worked step 4, 5, and 6 all over again, I finally realized that it was that combination of working those steps with a higher power that worked with me that would relieve me of my guilt and shame. I had made so many crazy decisions in my life. As I said before, I had to evaluate what are those barriers to my happiness. My motives were terrible. I wanted structure because I didn't want bad things to happen. And I had to go back to that childhood to say, how do those things impact my life? My sponsor said this is a disease of communication and this is a disease of relationships. And absolutely, I had burned every possible end of that for both of them. I guess it was 2006. Yeah, it was New Year's Eve 2006. My sponsor got invited by another Al-Anon person out of Birmingham named Philip to go to a program party. So I went with her, and there was, you know, where you set the, it was a, people bring a dish, and where you in the dining room where people put their dishes, there was a guy who said, you should try the shrimp and grits. And I just smiled and said, okay, that's really nice. and I walked out. And a little while later, somebody said, where's Mike? And somebody else said, oh, he's in the kitchen pushing his shrimp and grits. And I looked over and I said, that's really funny. Well, 2 days later, he didn't speak to me at all, but 2 days later, the secretary comes in and says, there's a Mike Burkhalter on the phone for you. And I said, do I know him? Well, I don't know. He says it's personal. I said, well, is he personally offended that his child didn't get a good grade? I mean, I don't know who this is. And she's like, well, do you want me to take a message? And I said, well, no, I'll probably have to call him back. And I didn't want to do that. And it was a rough time of the year. So I get on the phone, I go, hello. And he goes, hey, my name is Mike. I don't know if you remember me. I'm the shrimp and grits guy. I'm like, yeah, I do remember you. And so that was in January. So I have to tell this story because he would be disappointed if I didn't. But in February, Valentine's came around. Well, we were dating, and I will say this, so we dated about a year and 3 months, and my husband is the slowest dater in the world. And I'm sure he was talking to his sponsor about it, because he dated like he was a program person. But February, I didn't know what to do. And we lived in Tuscaloosa. You weren't going to get a restaurant. It was a college town. So I said, well, I'll cook. Well, I don't cook. So I had to take all day off. I cooked baked chicken, asparagus, and rice. Those are the only three things I cooked. I had to take off all day. But I thought I would get him a Valentine's gift. Well, I was traveling a lot with my job, and every single time, because he was living in Birmingham, every single time I went to the airport, he would say, I'm going to meet you at the airport in the leopard skin thongs. And I'd be like, oh, that's really funny. So for Valentine's, I went to Love Stuff. And Love Stuff is a concrete building in Duncanville, Alabama, that has no windows and probably videotapes. So I put on a hat and these big glasses just in case I ever wanted to run for public office. And I go stand at the door, and the lady says, can I help you? And I said, probably not. I'm looking for men's leopard skin thongs. And she said, oh, yeah, we have a whole rack of them right over there. I said, you have got to be kidding me. So I go over, pick me out some leopard skin thongs. I buy them. I take them back. I put them underneath his napkin just like this because they're small. We sit down to eat. He pulls his napkin off. He sees them. He says, what's that? I said, well, the next time you tell me you're going to show up in leopard skin thongs, I expect you to do that. He says, oh, okay. So he keeps eating. About 10 minutes in, he says, you need to close the curtains. I said, those aren't real curtains. He goes, okay, well, the neighbors are going to get a show. And I thought, okay, because at this point, believe it or not, thank you to the program, we had not slept together. So I thought, oh, he's going to take me on the dining room table. No. He gets buck naked, puts those leopard skin thongs on, starts turning around and saying, take a look, because this is the best it's ever going to look. He takes those leopard skin thongs off, puts his clothes back on, sits back down, and keeps eating. And I thought, I am either dating a sociopath or my next husband. And he is now husband number three. So on April 19th, 2008, I married two men. I married Mike and I married Christian. And I became the lowest life form society has to offer, the stepmom. And Christian and I are kindred spirits. I could tell you about standing on the sidelines as that stepmom and watching the disease of alcoholism bring police, mental health hospitalizations, special services in schools, yelling, court orders. I can tell you all about that. But instead, I'm going to tell you how we drug him to Alateen. We drug him to Al-Anon. When he was 16 years old, he came to live with us. At 16, they give you the ACT. He made a 13. I think they give you 9 for filling out your form correctly. And I said, do you want to go to college? He said, yes. I said, you got some work to do. He got accepted to 9 out of 10 colleges that he wanted to apply to, and he made a 3.4 and has a college degree today. And that, what I learned is the disease of alcoholism is a family disease. It takes everybody down to its bottom. But the 12-step programs give people an opportunity to change those dynamics. Do I believe that all of his problems have been solved? No. Do I believe that we've planted the seed? Yes. He still is deeply and profoundly affected by the disease of alcoholism. I do a lot of service work today. People ask why I do that service work. I will tell you one story about that treasury job that I told you about earlier. So 3 area assemblies in, so this was about 9 months into my term as treasurer, I had presented the budget 3 times. Well, there is a saying in the Al-Anon closing that says, though you may not like all of us, you'll come to love us in a very special way. Well, Sylvia was one of those, though you may not like all of us, people to me. And Sylvia comes up to me and she says, you know, your math is wrong. And I said, what do you mean my math is wrong? She said, your math is wrong. The budget doesn't add up. And I'm like, you are kidding me. I said, that's not possible. You know, I had proven that when I was 10 and knew that, you know, had to learn that 420s don't equal 100. And she said, no, go look at it. And so I went and looked at it, and she was absolutely 100% correct. And that's when I began to love Sylvia, because I realized she told me the truth. I love the truth. She told me the truth. And I cried and I cried and I cried because I had made this mistake. And my sponsor comes over to me and she says, you're a trusted servant, just like it says in the traditions. You are not an employee. It's okay to make a mistake. And that was the first time in my life I had been given permission to make a mistake and have people still tell me they love me. So I do service work because, believe it or not, I mess up all the time. But believe it or not, nobody gets all freaky. Nobody is telling me, oh my God, you're terrible. You're terrible at this. They say nice things even though you know you've made a mistake. So I keep at it. My sponsor used to like to say, Carmen, you're one of these people who for some reason is not able to make a lot of situations better. But you can make them worse. You're very good at making them worse. So figure out how you're going to stay out of the fray so you don't make it worse. And I have carried that into, to me, that's steps 7 through 9 really in action, because I do have a responsibility to make sure that I don't make a situation worse and that I'm out there trying to, you know, work my steps all over again because I've blown up my life. I've learned today that I don't have to have extreme self-reliance. I have a responsibility to not isolate. And what I have a tendency to do is I isolate and then I don't ask for help, or I don't think somebody else has something that they can offer. And I have to work on that. And that's just the reality of my disease. Today, I try to be positive. I try to focus on this maturity. You know, what does that my program tell me about a mature spiritual person? What would a mature spiritual person do? I have a lot of gratitude for this program. I have a lot of gratitude for AA. I practice having loving, healthy interactions with people. My communication sometimes is still terrible. My husband will say, after I've said like three sentences, he'll say, I don't think I heard anything except the pronouns, he, she, it, and they, and so I'm not real sure what you're talking about. And I'm like, what, you're not a mind reader? Because I want people to read my mind. I learned that fear is not a reasonable basis for life decisions. And in Al-Anon, we say fear is false evidence appearing real. And I think that's probably the root of all of my step one problems in not being able to focus on reality. You know, I've heard some people in this program say that they aspire to be serene and not necessarily happy. I don't happen to agree with that. Happiness is my goal. Happy, joyous, and free. And if it doesn't make me happy today or it interferes with my happiness, then I have to reevaluate, because I spent many, many, many years being miserable. I don't feel like it's necessary for me to be miserable anymore. And therefore, I'm going to focus on whatever it is that's happy, joyous, and free. If you're new to this program, whether you're in Al-Anon or whether you're in AA, I will tell you what they told me. Keep coming back till you want to come back. And you may find that 33 years later, you're up here and you're willing to tell your story. And if one person heard one thing out of that story that said, you know what, I can get behind this program because of that, then that's a great thing. But thank y'all for listening, and I appreciate being here.